Thank you for tuning into the Talking Information Center. My name is Duncan. Today I'll be reading from the New Republic magazine, dated June of 2026. First article I will read is in the State of the Nation section. It is entitled Sowing Doubt and submitted by Grace Seegers. Soybean farmers are grappling with falling sales, rising costs, and labor shortages, all consequences of Trump administration policies. Most are still standing by the president. Brett Niebling leaned against the door of his small office space, facing the array of computers and instruments that controlled several mechanical functions on his farm. The room was little more than an air-conditioned box, with scattered stools and a whiteboard on one wall. One of his farm dogs, a brown Labrador and known menace, idled outside the door. His roughly 2,500-acre farm in Highland, Kansas, is in the northeast corner of Kansas, the state, functions because of its equipment in this room. A machine to Niebling's right facilitated movement of harvested crops into specific grain bins, while one on his left controlled the drying of corn, a necessary preparation before it could be sold. The office has another purpose. It's where Niebling calculates how to keep his family-run farm afloat. Soybean farmers have been hit particularly hard during President Donald Trump's second term. The global trade war the president launched shortly after returning to office last year resulted in massive retaliatory duties on U.S. commodities from a number of major consumers, notably China. The Iran war has only made things worse. The closure of the Strait of Hormuz, a vital global shipping channel, in March led to a massive spike in oil and fertilizer costs. When I spoke to him on an exceedingly windy day in late March, Niebling described the current economic situation for farmers as tough more than a dozen times. That situation is often compounded by the president's chaotic social media announcements, which can move billions more or less instantaneously. It seems like we've got a market around tweets sometimes, says Niebling, who is the president of the Kansas Soybean Association. Some farmers say the situation is more severe than the 2018 trade war with China in Trump's first term, when Kansas farmers alone lost nearly $1 billion in sales of soybean and sorghum, another major crop in the state. In the first 8 months of 2025, soybean exports to China had fallen to around a quarter of what they were the previous year. And from the end of May through November 2025, the United States exported no soybeans whatsoever to China. Brazil, the largest producer of soybeans in the world, now provides the vast majority of China's soybeans. We've seen soybeans become much more of a geopolitical pawn than a trading discussion, than a market discussion, said Jonathan Kappas, an associate professor of law and policy at the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Soybeans aren't simply a commodity in Trump's second term. They're a crucial front in a global trade war and a key part of a grinding fight with China that will shape the future of geopolitics. Family farms like Niebling's, moreover, offer a window into the costs and consequences of the president's economic and foreign policy for regular Americans. Prices are rising for everyone, but farmers have been hit particularly hard. For them, the global is now local. The decisions made by the Trump administration may be temporary, but their consequences will be lasting. They are already devastating. Despite their unhappiness with Trump's trade policies, many farmers haven't lost their trust in him. This is in line with attitudes toward farming itself, which is an exercise in optimism and a myriad adverse conditions. Similarly, there's a prevailing hope that the White House and Congress will address farmers' needs in the long term, even if all evidence points to the contrary. Farmers have always struggled with the impact of political turmoil. Older farmers speak about the economic stresses they felt nearly half a century ago during the Carter and Reagan administrations. The 1980s were defined by a full-blown agricultural crisis that resulted in a dramatic loss in farmland value, mass foreclosures, corporate consolidation, and rural flight. Supporting American farmers through federal subsidies has been a priority for the federal government since the Great Depression. Cognizant of farmers' importance to the economy and as a voting bloc, even the Trump White House has attempted to insulate farmers from the full impact of its trade war. Last December, the administration announced the distribution of $12 billion in one-time payments to farmers. Around the same time, roughly $11 billion was dedicated to the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, which particularly targeted corn and soybean farmers. Kansas received $888 million in payments through this program, the third highest amount of any state. As of April, the state had received $773 million in payments. The farmers with whom I spoke in late March described the aid in existential terms. Right now, my financial projections for the year are to break even, and that included the aid payment. Without the aid payment, I basically would have been looking at a loss of that same amount, said Ryan Johnson, referring to the amount of the per-acre payment rate offered by the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program. Johnson is a corn and soybean farmer in Berryton, roughly a 15-minute drive south of Topeka. Soybean farmers have received massive subsidies in recent years. Coppice, for instance, noted that the massive payments farmers received in the wake of the 2018 trade war were followed by significant COVID-era assistance. In 2020 and 2021, the U.S. Department of Agriculture provided roughly $31 billion to offset losses for nearly 1 million producers across the country. In recent years, farmers have been able to rely upon the expectation that they will receive generous government assistance. But simply distributing payments during times of hardship, in amounts that may not even fully cover the depth of losses, will in the long term create a situation that allows us to kind of not make tough decisions or have difficult conversations, said Coppice. The farmers I spoke to recognized that in the long term, economic aid is unsustainable. I kind of view it as filling your gas tank. You can take that money, it fills your gas tank, but immediately you start pumping from the gas tank. And then, unless you have the markets in place to keep it full, it runs out, said Scott Gigstad, the chair of the Kansas Soybean Association. Many of them believe that Congress has shirked its duty by not passing the Farm Bill. The massive omnibus legislative package that governs agricultural, nutrition, and conservation policy and delivers subsidies to farmers and food assistance to those in need. Roughly 80% of the Farm Bill is devoted to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the program formerly known as food stamps. The most recent Farm Bill expired in 2023, and Congress has simply extended its provisions in subsequent years without updating or expanding it. The result, Coppice said, is a situation in which the federal government was essentially treating farmers as pass-through entities. The aid it delivers is immediately transferred to landlords, multinational fertilizer and chemical companies, and seed companies. We're going into this planting season, Coppice said, but nothing has been done to fix the larger problems farmers are facing. We haven't tried anything. Just talk about more payments and complain about the fact that costs stay high, he said. Making a one-time payment to farmers can help them afloat, but it won't solve the larger economic and geopolitical issues created by tariffs and international conflict. Other countries' loss of faith in the United States as a trading partner won't be addressed by offering money to producers when they can't sell their goods internationally. Coppice compared the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program to a painkiller, treating a symptom, not an underlying cause. Going forward, making payments will make it all worse, he said. You sort of use payments when you expect to get back to normal. There may not be a back to normal in this situation, in which case payments are really problematic. Still, frustration with Trump's trade policies does not necessarily translate to disapproval of the president himself. Initially skeptical of Trump, Johnson voted for a third-party candidate in 2016, but he found the president's first term to be effective and supported him in the 2020 and 2024 elections. Today, he said he was generally pleased with Trump's second-term performance, adding that he was shocked by how much Trump accomplished last year. Joe Newland, who is the president and chair of the Kansas Farmers Bureau, is less enthusiastic, but still supportive. He's probably not supportive of 100% of Trump's actions by any means, maybe not 75%, but he believes that administration officials working on trade are some of the best minds that we've had in probably many years, close quotes. There has been some recent good news. Last fall, China also pledged to buy at least 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans in the first 2 months of 2025, and at least 25 million metric tons in each of the three subsequent years, although these levels are lower than what China has imported in years past. Do we have his ear all the time? No, I mean, nobody does. Let's face it, Newland said, referring to Trump. But if you have the cabinet's level ear, that's huge. The president has reneged on some signature campaign promises, such as not entering any new international conflicts and ensuring lowered gas prices. But Nick Lewandowski, the executive director of the Kansas Farmers Union, observed that Trump was honest about his intention to implement higher tariffs throughout his 2024 presidential campaign, and that farmers knew what was coming down the pike. Trump has always said that he's going to do tariffs, you know, and we're going to get into that trade war. If there's anything he didn't lie about, that's it, said Lewandowski. The tariffs and the long-term consequences of the war in Iran are not the only Trump administration actions affecting farmers. Farming has been plagued with labor shortages, particularly for manual work in recent years, positions that are frequently filled by migrants. The Trump administration's crackdown on legal and illegal immigration, as well as difficulty reforming the H-2A visa program, which supports the bringing in agricultural workers to the United States, has exacerbated those shortages. Even Trump's cuts in foreign aid have affected farmers. Tom Geisel, who farms wheat, corn, soybeans, and alfalfa in western Kansas, called the functional closure of USAID, an agency that helped provide food assistance across the world, a gut punch. USAID was a major purchaser of grain sorghum grown in the state through the Food and for Peace program. Kansas produces more than half of the world's sorghum. With a buyer, millions of pounds of milo were left on the ground, or without a buyer, millions of pounds were left on the ground in 2025 with no place to store them. There are literally mountains of grain sorghum out here piled on the ground, said Geisel. The upshot of this uncertainty for younger Kansas farmers is a persistent sense of dread. The pressure on them is so great. Am I going to be the generation that loses the farm? Explained Newland. Dealing with the weather, dealing with commodity prices, dealing with the government, with the bank, there's so many different things that's weighing on them. Indeed, over the years, farming has increasingly become an old-timer's game. The median age of farmer is 58, and in 2025, 40% of U.S. farmland was owned by farmers aged 65 and older. Around 15,000 farms nationwide closed in 2025, including 700 in Kansas, which also saw a 10% increase in Chapter 12 bankruptcy filings designed for family farmers and fishermen. Such challenges can weigh heavily on young farmers. Newland knows of half a dozen suicides within a 30 to 40 mile radius, most recently a 22-year-old who lived nearby. Many of the old-timers are thinking of throwing in the towel. A lot of these guys are wanting to get out of this because they've been through a lot of hard times over their lifetime, and now it's like, okay, I'm done with this, said Lewandowski. But many, like Niebling, are determined not to give up. No matter how bad things are, I don't want to say it's in your blood, but it's in your blood. You know, it's just like there's that draw to the ground that you've been connected to, he said. There's so much pressure on us anyway. There's so many things that we can't control that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Also, he added, it's tough right now. This article has been submitted by Grace Seegers, who's a staff writer at the New Republic magazine. Next article I will read is also in the State of the Nation section, entitled Joker's Wild. Why is one of America's leading advocates for gambling addicts now pushing betting bills? Submitted by Danny Funt. Minnesota State Senator John Marty was furious with the nonprofit National Council on Problems Gambling, so much so that he couldn't wait until morning to fire off an angry email. I am deeply disappointed to see this, he wrote in an NCPG staffer one night in April of 2025, after a Senate colleague shared the draft of an op-ed by Keith White, NCPG's longtime executive director and one of America's most prominent advocates for mitigating gambling harm, endorsing an industry-backed bill that would legalize sports betting in Minnesota. Marty, a Democrat and staunch critic of the gambling business, was dismayed. NCPG traditionally remains neutral on gambling expansion, but that hadn't stopped White from speaking forcefully over the years about dangers associated with the online betting boom. After a 2018 Supreme Court decision, Murphy versus National Collegiate Athletic Association opened the floodgates by declaring a 1992 federal ban on sports gambling unconstitutional. White warned Congress, "This Frankenstein's monster of advertising, access, and action is unprecedented." Returning to Capitol Hill 6 years later, by which Americans were legally wagering about $150 billion every year, White declared, "The evidence is overwhelming that expanded sports betting has led to increased harm on a national scale." Yet a few months after delivering that impassioned testimony, White was pushing to legalize sports betting in Minnesota, one of about a dozen holdout states, arguing that people there were wagering with black market bookies, and a legal, regulated marketplace is far safer than unregulated platforms that lack basic safeguards. The Gopher State had previously rejected several sports wagering proposals, but White's endorsement, which argued that this bill included the strongest consumer protections in the country, was viewed by some state senators as a game changer. Marty hadn't noticed the bio at the bottom of White's op-ed describing his NCPG tenure in the past tense. The NCPG staffer he emailed provided further clarity. White is a paid lobbyist of the Sports Betting Alliance now, quotes. And so they're paying him for this opinion, the person wrote. To say it's frustrating to us is an understatement, not only because he has changed course from his 26 years at NCPG, but because it leads to mix-ups like this. Marty shared their exchange on the condition after the New Republic not identify the staffer. The Sports Betting Alliance lobbies on behalf of five top sports gambling operators, FanDuel, DraftKings, BetMGM, Fanatics Sportsbooks, and Bet365. After Marty told his colleagues about White's new affiliation, he said support for the bill collapsed. Minnesota still hasn't authorized bookmaking, though this past April, White wrote another op-ed in the Minnesota Star Tribune urging the state to reconsider. Marty called White's turn to lobbying and his efforts to disguise those shifting loyalties disturbing, though he added, maybe the guy just changed his mind on all this. White insisted that's not the case, telling me, I've got 30 years of being pretty consistent on these issues, and that's, I think, what people value. He describes himself as a strategic advisor to SBA, and the organization, he does not provide lobbying services. Yet, there's no doubt White has been dispatched to influence lawmakers nationwide on behalf of the gambling industry. In Colorado, Hawaii, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Virginia, and Washington, D.C., he's written op-eds and testified in favor of expanding legal sports betting and online casino gambling, while opposing efforts to curtail those industries or raise their taxes. The tobacco industry was notorious for co-opting trusted health experts to vouch for the safety of smoking. Today's gambling giants are deploying a similar strategy, and White is perhaps the most egregious example. Considering he's leveraging his reputation as NCPG's longtime leader to advocate the interests of sports betting corporations, some former colleagues feel betrayed. Americans have legally wagered more than $650 billion since that Supreme Court decision, and nearly half of bettors say they've felt ashamed after losing a bet. Evidence is piling up, legalization causing more bankruptcies, lowering credit scores, and surges in gambling addiction, putting the industry on the defensive more than ever. Recruiting former critics like White is a powerful tool for sustaining the betting business's meteoric growth. Asked why he's endorsed Minnesota's sports betting bill while failing to disclose his ties to SBA, White demurred, I don't think I was involved in any of that. I then sent him the Minnesota op-ed to jog his memory, and he conceded he should have disclosed working for SBA. Later, I asked why he supported that bill, proposed by State Senator Nick Frintz, as opposed to one from Marty, which included significantly more aggressive consumer protections, such as banning wagering at stadiums, prohibiting misleading risk-free promotions, and requiring sportsbooks to intervene if customers exhibit potential signs of addiction, all issues White has expressed concern about in the past. White said he considered Frentz's bill more pragmatic, but he added, part of the issue was, of course, the industry was behind Frentz's bill, and that's the group that I'm working with, the online sportsbook operators. The nonprofit that became NCPG was co-founded in 1972 by Dr. Robert Custer, a psychiatrist whose pioneering research led to the official recognition of gambling as potentially addictive. The Washington, D.C.-based organization was run by volunteers until 1998, when it received a grant to hire its first full-time staffer, an executive director. White, then in his late 20s and serving as director of research for the gambling industry's new trade group, the American Gaming Association, got the job. It was not uncontroversial to hire someone who had industry connections, White told me in 2024 for my book Everybody Loses, The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. But the folks on the board realized that working with the industry was something that the National Council was going to need to do. White helped expand NCPG from an annual budget of about $100,000 to more than $5 million by 2024, supporting a staff of 13. About 20% of that funding comes from gambling companies, and roughly $2 million comes from the NFL, which, of course, is now heavily invested in gambling. White allowed any company to become an NCPG member as long as it paid dues, regardless of whether it took steps to mitigate gambling harm. Some people noticed a gradual shift at NCPG, including Dave Yeager, who developed a gambling addiction while serving in the military and is now in recovery, helping people across the country with gambling problems. He recently served on NCPG's board. Though he admires White personally, Yeager told me, it felt like we started catering to the industry far more than we were catering to serving people who struggle with gambling addiction. Still, when called upon to discuss the risks of gambling during his tenure at NCPG, White was inexhaustible, giving, by his estimation, about 2,000 media interviews over his time. The executive directorship was hardly glamorous. His office could have passed for an assistant professor. His approach at NCPG and in the consulting highlights a profound divide among gambling health advocates. White believes sportsbooks can reduce gambling harm by encouraging customers to bet responsibly. Critics of that model say preaching responsibility gets gambling operators off the hook for making their products increasingly addictive, while promoting the cruel stigma that gamblers with a mental health disorder really have a character defect. One of those critics is Harry Levant, a recovering gambling addict who serves as director of gambling policy for the Public Health Advocacy Institute of Northeastern University. Open quotes, "I believe at both the state and federal level in the rank and files, there are some wonderful, caring people who desperately want to effectuate change and protect people," he said. "I believe they are trapped in a system called the responsible gaming model that is scientifically flawed, ethically dangerous, and ethically compromised. And I think the single biggest proponent of this model for years was Keith White. White's peers in the advocacy world are split about whether he's sold out. Some said he deserves the benefit of the doubt that he's partnering with the industry to advance the same safeguards he supported at NCPG. Others said it's exactly because he's so trusting that his lobbying is uniquely damaging, lending legitimacy to discredited industry talking points. His critics said the Sports Betting Alliance's deal with White reflects a broader industry strategy to neutralize health experts and counter mounting fears of a gambling-fueled public health crisis. Many still wonder why White left NCPG in the first place. The organization released a curt statement in 2025, January, thanking him for his service, and he posted cryptically on LinkedIn that it is now time for a new challenge. NCPG and White declined to address his departure for this story, but multiple people told me the organization's board of directors voted unanimously to dismiss him, frustrated that NCPG wasn't growing to meet the moment and concerned that White had become too dominant a presence, unwilling to relinquish more control and visibility to NCPG's state affiliates. In his final year on the job, public tax filings show White made $158,000. After he was fired, the SBA offered him a significant raise, $20,000 a month, according to a former colleague who said White shared that figure with them. White declined to comment. White told me he's proud to have consistently occupied the center lane. The slogan of his consultancy is promoting responsible gambling to help prevent gambling addiction. One of its first clients was the Sports Betting Alliance. Whether he believed in their approach or not, he might have had a hard time declining such a significant payday. Public records show he and his wife filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy in 2011, having accumulated about $145,000 in unsecured debt, most of it on credit cards. Their repayment plan was completed in December of 2016. Financial decisions from more than a decade ago have no bearing on my current work, White told me. Last September, he announced he was also consulting for FanDuel. Asked to describe what changes he's encouraged, White said customers should have to opt out of setting personal deposit limits or opposed to having to opt in to that tool, and that for VIPs, or gamblers who receive extravagant perks in exchange for losing staggering amounts of money, deposit limits should be mandatory. He said FanDuel tells him it's moving to making these changes. But as for comment, the company declined to make that commitment. comment, saying, "Keith brings a valuable perspective and a strong track record in advancing player protection, and we're fortunate to work with him on a range of responsible gambling initiatives. He also makes $275 an hour consulting for the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, offering advice on how best to regulate sportsbook advertising, VIP programs and wagering limits imposed on winning bettors. His contract, obtained through a public records request, includes an elaborate rundown of his credentials, but makes no mention of his consulting for the betting industry. A commission spokeswoman said White disclosed his work for SBA and FanDuel, and that the commission's lawyers determined it did not need to be included in his contract, adding, "The commission does not consider his working with sports wagering operators as a conflict. A Massachusetts law barring the regulator from employing people who have worked recently for a licensee," the spokesperson clarified, "applies to casino gaming and not sports wagering." White is hardly the first person from a gambling nonprofit to accept industry money. Maybe people feel that they can contribute to change without, as opposed from within, as opposed to outside, said Jeff Wasserman, a Delaware-based lawyer who's in recovery for gambling addiction and previously served on NCPG's board. "I understand it. Does that make me happy about it? No, it's disappointing." He said he takes issue with White trumpeting his NCPG credentials while doing SBA's bidding. "When you use your past experience to promote something that is contrary to a lot of the principles that you once hopefully had and certainly advocated for, yeah, that's pretty scummy." Skipping ahead slightly in the story due to time constraints, all of this contradicts statements White made in recent years. In 2021, he warned of a race to the bottom, leaving families burdened with gambling-related addiction, and as evidence of that harm, cited a rise in calls to gambling helplines. In 2024, he told me that advertising is such a big thing, contributing to gambling problems, but when asked for this story about the risks of excessive advertising, he said, "I don't give it as much weight, and I never have." Over the years, he's been adamant that sports books can't be trusted to self-police and that states must impose tighter guardrails. But one of SBA's core objectives, as its president, Joe Maloney, articulated in March, is to defend against market restrictions in legalized jurisdictions. I asked White how advancing that mission is comparable with his values. "In my work with SBA, they have supported good RG, or responsible gaming, regulations," he said. "That will be tested this year, as Congress considers a proposal to allocate one-third of revenue collected by the long-standing federal excise tax on sports betting, 25 cents for every $100 wagered, toward gambling addiction research, prevention, and treatment." At NCPG, White was a staunch supporter of an earlier version of that bill, which the gambling industry fought to defeat. "At the time, White told me it was a damning reflection on sports books that they're so opposed to government funding of gambling research. They want to count the revenue," he had said. "They do not want to count the bodies." But NCPG supporting federal funding for research, White added, "we're on the right side of history." When we spoke recently, he pledged to support this latest bill. In a statement, Maloney said, "the federal excise tax should be repealed, not repurposed." I asked White if SBA's opposition to federally funded research might make him reconsider working for the group. Almost whispering, he replied, "it would." This article has been submitted by Danny Funt, who's the author of Everybody Loses, The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. That's all the time I have for today. Thank you for tuning in to the Talking Information Center and the New Republic Magazine. My name is Duncan. Have a great week.